Make sure this is working. It says it's recording. Okay. Well, welcome.
We didn't know. We don't get emails. We don't get told.
About what?
Today. We didn't know who's doing the Bible.
Yeah,
if you refer to the website, that's probably the fastest way to find out.
That's a bit complicated. Normally it comes on a regular thing every night.
Complicated. You type in narcisse.org.
And you've got to turn the computer on.
And then on the front, you do have to turn the computer on.
So we're all just getting adjusted here. If you could find your seat and make sure you have a Bible that has all parts of the Bible. Okay. Okay, so it's February 28, 2015. Welcome. See, everyone has Bibles and computers. The digital, the non-digital. So we'll start with some prayer. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us here this morning and all the things that had to happen to bring each person here. And thank you that you're working in our life, even when we don't feel it or see it. And we pray that our thoughts would be your thoughts, and that you would keep working and keep showing us things, keep surprising us, and let us be obedient. And even when it looks hazy, let us follow what we know is true. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So, as we all know, next week is Purim. Wine is in the air. Everything, if you are around young children at this time of the year, you've already been aware that it's Purim. There have been probably several dress-up days at school. You know, they'll do a sport day, a pajama day, a hat day. Yeah, we still got 2 days in front of us, and then the actual dress-up day. So that's coming during this coming week. And so, of course, I'm thinking about Purim. And one of the things you do every year is to read through the story of Esther, the scroll of Esther in the Bible. And I was just thinking about what a wild story it is to read every year. You know, out of all the stories you could read in the Bible, and here it is, this holiday that is not even in the Torah. You know, it seems it's a latecomer on the stage. It doesn't happen in Israel. Mm-hmm. It's just this crazy thing. And here we get to read it every year. And I was shy to do any kind of Bible study on it because, you know, anything you do every year, you think, what more could I possibly say? But that's the whole thing of the Bible, is that even though we read it every year, we actually expect to find something new or find something that becomes suddenly applicable or relevant to us. And so there's never a point of saturation. There's always going to be something we can get from it.
The gift that keeps on giving.
The gift that keeps on giving. And But for us, in order for us to get that, we do have to slow down and actually read it and not wait for a Sunday school teacher to summarize it for us. Because once you summarize it, you can only do that a couple times. And then you have it, then it becomes boring. It's only when you actually read the details that it starts to become exciting again. Even if the details are tedious. That's your little irony of the case. So my personal little anecdote this morning is that you remember in chapter 6, the flipping of the story. I'll stand up for better projection. The reversal in the story of Esther happens when the king has no sleep. You remember that?
Yeah.
And you look in verse 6:1. Esther 6:1 says,
they order the book of the Chronicles.
That's right.
The record of his reign to be brought in and read to him.
Balayla hahu nadadash natamelech. Okay, the king's sleep wandered. And this is where traditionally we have, what's the problem with the book of Esther?
God is not there.
No mention of God, God's name, or anything overtly religious. And very fascinating, because some personalities have a real problem with this. And so they want to hurry up and get back all the clear titles and everything. And other personalities revel in the fact that there's no overt mention of God. But so there's always this tension, and traditionally they fix it by saying, in that night, instead of saying Nadada is she wandered off, referring to the sleep that wandered off from the king. Nadada Shnat HaMelech, meaning Shenat HaMelech. So instead of Nadada, you just take that off and you make the hey be the short name of God, which, you know, the shorthand for God is hey with a chukchik. You can also write a gulyud. There's various ways of doing it. That's the name that you don't speak. So something to the effect of, it should be more causative then, but Nadadya, like where God made the sleep wander off. But this is all far-fetched, don't worry. but just to show you that tension in the text, and back to my opening, that my own sleep wandered last night. As I was wondering whether I should talk about Purim or not. Nothing new, but the wind kept waking me up. And so the second time I thought, well, is the wind waking me up or should I get up?
Okay, the wind's coming from Iran, so.
Yeah. Is it wind, or I can make another play on that. Ruach. In Hebrew, as probably other languages, is wind or spirit. So is it the Holy Spirit saying something, or is it me not sleeping? And the book of Esther is a great book for these kinds of questions, because when you're living on a human sphere, sometimes it's hard to tell, and you only see in hindsight whether it was the wind or the Holy Spirit. But it also, I'll just give you a brief aside, also made me start thinking about God speaking to kings. We have many stories, some of which are paralleled in our Esther story, mm-hmm. of God speaking to foreign kings. And you think, how ironic. Here we as people trying to follow God struggle to hear him. You know, we fast, we pray, and then he just shows up in a dream to Pharaoh and talks to him. And you think, hello? Is that fair? And you know, they don't deserve it, so to speak. They're idolaters, they're gluttons, adulterers, you name it, and they get a revelation. But then it drew me back to the whole theme of subtlety. Like when God created nature, he likes his system. He put it in place and he generally leaves it alone. Sometimes he has to break in for whatever reason and he does a miracle. But a lot of times he's hands off. And so is there something about God? He prefers to be subtle. So when we really don't get it, he has to talk to us. And if you look at it that way, well, I don't want to go that far because I don't want to say if God's talking to you it's because you didn't get it. He can do anything he wants. But if you don't hear direct messages all the time, don't take offense. It might be a compliment. You have the whole rabbinic idea of, let's see, let me get it right, Abraham and Noah, right? Who here knows where I'm going?
That Abraham walks in front of him.
That's right. Noah. One walks with God and one walks before God. So the idea is if you're walking ahead of God, it means you've learned. It's, you're more like a teenager or a young adult where you can walk on your own and God is just there to like, oh, no, no, step back. But you're walking before him. Where if you're walking with God, it's more like a kid. You have to hold his hand and be told, okay, turn left, turn right.
Sarah Lanier's language would be directive and...
directive leadership and...
the second one.
Coaching.
It's before coaching, no.
But with the two footprints, he's carrying
distant,
you in the sand.
Distant.
So.
Well, that would be the baby's coach.
It was the child and the adolescent.
Right.
It was that second one.
So,
by the way, are you going to Daniel with this verse?
No, I'm not going to go to Daniel, should I?
Because in Daniel 6, verse 19, mm-hmm. it's talking about Darius, and, you know, Daniel's put in the lion's den.
Uh-huh.
And, then,
and he can't sleep.
Right. And in the Aramaic, it's the Shinte Natat Alohi. And then the Hebrew, this version of translated to Aramaic, they did Ishnaho, Mimenu.
Yeah.
So.
So the same thing, the sleep, the king's sleep wanders away from him.
19.
That's from Daniel 6:19, right when Daniel's in the lion's den. So yeah, you could, it might be interesting.
They're both Persian kings.
They're both Persian kings. And we're going to talk a little bit about Persian kings. It would be interesting to do a whole study of all the kings who can't sleep in the Bible and just compare all those stories. And we kind of chuckle, but the cool thing about the Bible is it asks you to make comparisons all the time. It's not just what it's saying, how it's saying it. It's constantly forcing you by the words to compare those same words somewhere else, what Gary just did. It's like, oh, hey, and Daniel says that exact phrase. I wonder how these two stories interpret each other. Or like what the story in Daniel should then say about Esther, or Esther about Daniel. And maybe that gets in a bit to the time of things. But before we talk too much without reading, I would actually like us to read. And so... let's turn to chapter 1 of Esther. And we are going to read how long should we read for? Maybe do 6 verses. Or, well, do the first. Let's stop with 4. 4. Who wants to do 4 verses?
I'd love to.
Okay, Jordan, read for us.
Reading from the JPS. It happened in the days of Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus, who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Nubia, in those days when King Ahasuerus occupied the royal throne in the fortress of Shushan, in the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all the officials and courtiers, the administration of Persia and Media, the nobles and the governors of the provinces in the service, and no fewer than 180 days he displayed the vast riches of his kingdom and the splendid glory of his majesty.
All right. What strikes you about the beginning of the story of Esther? What can you tell me about it?
They gave you the reign of the king right from India to Ethiopia, and Persia as it is now is only like Iran and just some towns. But originally Persia was three times
was an empire. Bigger. Sure. Yeah, Persia was an empire. Is this a typical biblical story or biblical book beginning?
No.
Usually it starts with the word of the Lord.
Do we ever have a time frame given in terms of a king's reign?
Israelite kings.
Yeah. Exactly. Israelite or Judah kings, right?
Yeah, but we get told he reigned for X number of years. He was a good king. He was a bad king. His mother was good, bad.
Well, you get told that in some.
But here you've got this incredible sort of splurge, like Valerie says, of this huge empire. He's got total control over 127 provinces, and he splashes out his wealth and is showing off just how rich he is. I mean,
right?
And not even Solomon did that in all his glory, you know.
Sure. So you have this huge display of wealth. But the first thing you hear, we're used with our biblical ears to hearing it happened in the reign of the king of so-and-so. But the shocking thing here is they're telling you this story, they're giving you the framework of the Persian king. Why did they say it happened in the 70th year of the exile of Judah? And who is this Persian king? Like, why are we talking about a Persian king? What does he have to do with anything of God?
Well, Cyrus was a Persian king, and he was mentioned even before he came into reign.
What was the name you said?
Cyrus.
Okay. So you want us to talk about Persian kings. Yes. The Achaemenid dynasty. How do you say that?
In English,
Achaemenid. That sounds
Achaemenid.
Weird to me. Anyway, who was the first king in this dynasty for the Persians? Valerie said his name in English. We call him Cyrus. And in Hebrew, what do we call him?
Koresh.
And why is Koresh so cool to us?
Because he lets the Jews come back and build a temple.
Or he's also known as the Mashiach.
Yes, who calls him Messiah? Who calls
Isaiah.
Him Messiah?
Isaiah.
God through Isaiah the prophet says, Koresh, my Messiah, and he calls him this because Koresh gave permission to the exiled people to come back and build a temple to their God. So he is considered very open-minded and good for the people of God.
What does the word mean? Koresh. Sunrise.
Maybe. You want to play with a name? You can play with a name.
No, I'm not playing. This is what
okay.
You come from the east.
The what year? Give me a year.
540.
Okay, the year I'm used to hearing is 539. But I don't know, maybe you have a different way of reckoning.
No.
Okay, so 539 is in history when we try to go back and piece together all these things. That's when he gave permission to the Jews. That's when he conquered Babylon, actually. So maybe 541 is what you're thinking when he gave them permission. I'm not sure of the little details of the years in between.
You find it in Ezra.
Mm-hmm. That's
in
right.
The book of Ezra and Nehemiah. His name is mentioned.
It for sure is. Okay, and so when this dynasty lasts until Dariavish, who is Darius the Third, and he dies in 330. And who comes on the world scene in 333?
Alexander
the Great. What's called Alex. So this is the dynasty, like the big Persian dynasty we're talking about. And our text is talking about Ahasuerus. So the question is, who is Ahasuerus? And basically, I'll put Cyrus in English here. This is what English people call him. Darius.
The Septuagint.
The Septuagint calls Ahasuerus
Isn't he also called Artaxerxes?
Yes, well, there's Xerxes and Artaxerxes. And Artaxerxes is the Greek for Artaxerxata. So, and Josephus and Septuagint line up with him.
Wait, which one?
He comes after Polish, right?
Artaxerxes.
Yeah.
You mentioned Daniel.
In the NIV, I have Xerxes and Ahasuerus. But who's your other guy? This Ahasuerus.
That's Artaxerxes.
He was the one right before.
Ahasuerus comes before Ahasuerus. Is he cool?
44 to 359. And I'm going to write you two options. This guy is the Greek Xerxes.
You know, make sure in English.
Xerxes and Arta Xerxes. And he is later, or wait, no, he's earlier. I should have reversed that.
Nehemiah, I think.
Yeah.
That he's his cupbearer.
Well, the LXX text in Esther 1 is Artaxerxes.
So Josephus and some Greek translators went with this guy, the later one. But most people would see the connection to this one. Not only Hashyarash sounds more like Ahasuerus. The name lines up. We can look quickly in Ezra. Someone wants to read Ezra 4, 4 through 7.
Which one sounds like Ahasuerus?
Hashyarash. More than Al-Tashasata.
With the
Tah. Yeah. Yah and Ve are connected often.
You want a rail?
Ahasuerus.
Ahasuerus. Right. Well, let's say you see
that. In the Bible, this is the word. This is the name written. And so you can see there's a lot more similarities to this name than that one. But who has for me Ezra 4, 4 through 7?
4, 4 to 7, yeah.
Yes.
And the peoples around them set up and discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, this is New International, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bislam, Mithridat, Tabiel, and the rest of his associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script and in the Aramaic language.
Sure.
Aramaic and translate.
What?
Xerxes is older than...
Yeah, I know. I just said that. I wrote that down.
As they're born in Aramaic.
But I think I wrote them down wrong, because what I want to say is most people.
Because you were connected to Nehemiah or Artaxerxes.
Right. Well, what he just read, this comes first, and then this, and then this. But in terms of identifying who this king is, there is some kind of formal thing during the reign of Xerxes against the people in Jerusalem, the Jews in Jerusalem. And if you can connect anything there with what happens in Esther, then maybe we're dealing with this thing. But there's several other things in favor of Xerxes. From other Greek historians,
His character seems to line up. It's very rash, fickle. He changes his mind. He can be very brutal. It seems to line up with Xerxes. He's known for a love of wine and women. That seems to line up with Esther. And
what king, though, would not be covered by that phrase?
Yeah. Well, there are those. Well, let's just say on a spectrum, of kings, certainly there would still be some room one way or another.
Carl would be upset if I was.
And there was a royal treasure in his day called Marduka, which may or may not be Mordechai. So I would just say we'll go with it. I think there's enough details that line up with Xerxes.
So can I just ask something? So what we've just read from Ezra, this is an Artaxerxes, so we're actually saying that he's a different guy. He's not.
I'm saying it's Xerxes, yeah.
You think this should be Xerxes? You think it should be the same one? I didn't look in the.
Well, it mentions both in Ezra.
In 6 and 7.
Yeah.
It mentions both.
It says at the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, next verse, at the days
of Artaxerxes. Where are you, David? Where are you?
And in the days of Artaxerxes.
David, where are you?
Verse 6 says, in the
in
reign of Xerxes. Verse 7 says, and in the days of Artaxerxes. Ezra 4.
Oh, yeah.
Ezra 4.
Oh,
the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem.
And then the next guy.
And could that be seen in light of Esther? Is the question.
And then the next guy is.
But why do I even bring this up? Well, obviously the story starts here, which is unusual.
Who really cares?
And the reason it's important is what I mentioned about Koresh. When was the temple, second temple, or the temple after the exile, when was it dedicated?
515
B.C. 515
B.C.
So you have, Jews have been given permission to go back to Israel. They've been given permission to build a temple. They've done it. It was very hard work. They had a lot of people against them.
So why is Esther marrying a Persian king?
So why is Esther in Persia? Why is she in Persia?
Go search your title.
Persia. Media.
Media, Persia, the Persian Empire. Why is she not back home? And
but they didn't all go home. I mean,
exactly.
There are a limited number that went back to build, but they didn't all go home.
Not anyone went back. And the people who went back struggled. They had serious struggles economically. They're just like today. So the book of Esther, if we were to tell the story today, it happens in New York City when there is an Israel. And that's important. Because up till now in the Bible, everything's been happening in Israel. And then you have an exile. And all the people, the stuff happening in exile, they're all looking forward to when they can get back to Israel.
And most of them don't come back.
And now all of a sudden, you have a story that happens when they had a choice. They could have been in Israel, and God's doing stuff in Israel and building a temple.
Wow.
But here we are. We're not in Israel. We're in Persia.
New York City.
We're in New York City.
Wall Street called, but not the wall.
We're with successful Jewish people that have integrated into a country they're living in and not gone back.
Right.
So this is the setting of our whole story, and it does make us keep asking questions.
And also, I connected with Daniel, because Daniel, when he had the 21 days, the angel was fighting against the king of Persia.
Right. The prince of Persia,
right. But the nature of Daniel is quite different.
The day is so powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, what's going on? It's just this week. It's just.
So in a sense, Esther is a book we can relate to because it's not so obvious. The divine part is not so obvious. And here it's happening
for a lot of people. Not everyone lives in Jerusalem. And yet God is working outside of Jerusalem, and he works in mysterious ways. And you notice about the book, it starts with these two huge banquets. And so at the end of the book, what do we get? What do we celebrate every year?
Purim.
Festivals.
And there's two banquets at the end. So the Jews have two banquets. The Persians have two banquets that every nation attends. So the Jews are attending the Persian two banquets, and then they end with two banquets. And so you could say, okay, great, they've totally assimilated. What's that about? But there are these subtle contrasts going on by comparing the two. The fact that there's two of each forces the comparison. And then once you compare them, then you can see the differences. So there's this tension going through the whole book about issues of what does it mean to be following God in a foreign country, for Jews particularly, and have we assimilated? Are we really the same? Or where is the difference? How do we live? And part of starting out this way is forcing us to rethink from what we're used to seeing in a biblical story. The other thing is what, if you read in verse 6 and 7, back to Esther 1, chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, you read of all kinds of fancy materials.
Sounds like you're much mold.
Boots and argaman.
And when they
build the temple. Temple materials. And so although, you know, we're in a Persian court, it's not Israel and it's not holy, you have these little references, oh, we have these temple things. And what's that doing here? Is this story really about Persia? Or is it trying to get you to think and connect back to the temple and the God of Israel? And so you have this plot that's given to you at face value, and it's funny and it's ridiculous. And then you have a very subtle underplot that makes you think. And this morning, of course, we won't cover answers to our thoughts, but we start the process of thinking. And every year, hopefully, you think and come up with new ideas and new new expressions of how God's moving.
The extravagance of Esther throughout. Mm-hmm. Everything is extravagant. Every detail.
You could almost say exaggerated.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting when you think of there's a face value that they're saying one thing that seems extreme and huge, and yet the subtle reading underneath is very sophisticated, where you could almost miss it.
Well, there seems to be in the prophets, especially the later prophets, this idea of being accepting where you are, whether you're in Babylon or
Ezekiel,
but where, like Ezekiel, the God's presence leaves the temple in that one vision of Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like God is no longer confined to one place. In the mindset of the people, it's a bigger vision.
Because that's the interesting thing in the ancient worldview. You know, you make a temple and you associate God's dwelling with that temple. There's a place. And so if you destroy the temple, God's lost his home. But if you build the temple back, he's back at home. And so what does that mean for the rest of it?
And it sort of just came to my mind. God, you know, this the whole story of Esther is to show the victory of God against the planning of Satan. Because Satan knows that the seed of the woman, back in Genesis, is going to come from God's people who were identified, especially after Abraham. So he wanted to eliminate God's people, who are the Jews, you know, out of Judah, who returned back to the land, you know, came the Messiah.
Right.
So this is a demonstration of God's victory over Satan and this.
Yeah, because Haman was an Amalekite, and the Amalekite was absolutely right. I'm sure.
Sure.
Not you know, anyone of the. Of the Satan used people, you know, whether Amalekites or...
So there's always this idea of redemption. Yeah. You have a story of salvation with God's people, and you have Satan trying to stop that. That's true. In the whole Bible, that's the one recurring theme that is consistent. Okay. Let's do some reading, some quicker reading. Let's see, can we start over here? And you can read from verse 7.
Chapter 1,
verse 7.
Beverages were served in an array of gold goblets, each with a different design. Royal wine flowed freely according to the king's bounty, and no restraint was placed on drinking. The king had ordered every wine steward in his household to serve as much as each person wanted.
Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women of King Ahasuerus's palace. On the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, Ahasuerus commanded Mehuman, Bista, Harbona, Bita, Abikta, Setar, and Sarkas, the seven eunuchs who personally served him, to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown. He wanted to show off her beauty to the people and the officials because she was very beautiful.
But when they conveyed the king's orders to Queen Vashti, she refused to come. This made the king furious and he burned with anger. He immediately consulted with his wise advisors, who knew all the Persian laws and customs, for we always asked their advice. The names of those men were Kashina, Kikesh, Abnaka, Tarshish, Mirs, Marcina, Memu, Ken, seven nobles of Persia and Media. They met with the kings regularly and held the highest position in the empire. What must be done to Queen Vashti, the king demanded? What penalty does the Lord provide for a queen who refuses to obey the king's orders properly sent through his eunuchs?
Okay, we'll take a pause there. First, two cultural tidbits. In Persia, it was accepted, like if the guys go off and have a banquet, they bring in
girls.
That are not so respectable. And so it was culturally, if you were a respectable woman, you don't go to the banquet when there's a bunch of guys drinking. So
whatever they want.
Culturally, Vashti is right to refuse to come, especially when the text points out they've been drinking 7 days. You know, this it would be dangerous for her to go in to this feast. And of course this whole little interplay sounds very funny if you have a sense of humor, which I think it's asking you to have. You know, the king, he doesn't even have a connection to his wife. You know, he's telling other people to go bring her. She's refusing back through those other people. And you could say, oh, well, that's royalty. But then, oh no, she told me no. What should I do? He turns to his advisors, his political advisors. Like, it's your wife, you know. You need your political advisors for this. So it's definitely, the story is poking fun at the whole Persian systems and the Persian king himself. Like, you are not very much, you're not appropriate. You're going through all the wrong ways.
I also like the fact that Vashti didn't want to it's a bit like somebody refusing to be, I don't know, Miss World or something. Made an object of, I think.
Sure.
So she's got a role in it too. I mean, it's not just wise, and it's not just she doesn't want to be deemed a prostitute like any other.
Right.
But she's also saying, give me a break, you know, I'm not going to be an object like this. Even if they'd only been drinking for 24 hours.
So then, in verse 16, the king has turned, maybe in his drunkenness he decides to make this a big deal. I don't know. So he makes it this whole big political thing and brings in the top people from his whole kingdom. And like, this is not an international affair, okay? This is your wife not wanting to come to your banquet. This is something stupid. But now he's made it one. And so his advisors have to kind of appease the king in his drunken inappropriateness and deal with what he's saying quasi-seriously.
I got a quote from Herodotus here. It says that they often deliberated without being drunk, but their major decisions, Herodotus says, were when they were drunk.
Well, actually, yeah, he goes on to say they had to pass a law two times.
Yeah,
once when you're drunk and once when you're sober. So that they would... I think Herodotus.
But would there be a law say something about...
Greek historian.
It's a Greek historian that says, no, there wouldn't be a law about... Why would you have a law about your wife? Nothing about it makes sense. But now that he's gone there, now he's got an advisor who's going to help him. Because you can't accuse the king of being an idiot, right? So now that he's made it an issue, you've got to play along. So he comes up with a very good way of making this an issue. If you look at verse 16. Someone can read verse 16 let's say, 18.
Then Memucan replied, in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. Did you say through 18?
Yeah.
This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord.
So he's saying, you want it to be an international problem? Let me see how I can make your statement work. Okay, yeah. If other women all across our whole empire start doing the same thing, you know, then you would have a mass coup or I don't know what. So Memucan comes up with a justification for the king and helps it be worth their time. Otherwise, maybe the seven advisors were sitting around snickering, you know, why are we even here? Who's going to come up with a solution to save face?
It's the same tactic as in Daniel, when the three wouldn't bow down when all the instruments were played. And
right.
That was the same thing that... We will have to put...
Well, Daniel does some of the same things that Esther does, that it makes fun of Persian law by quoting it. We get in the next verse, verse 19. You know, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be made and let it be written in the laws of Madai and Paras that can't be changed, that Vashti shouldn't come before the king ever again. And her kingdom should be given to her friend who is better than her.
Or obedient.
Now this is an interesting thing. Malchuta yitena melech lereuta hatova mimena. Who does that remind you of? Whose kingship or whose kingdom was given to a friend that was better than them?
David and Saul.
David and Saul, exactly. And so these are one of those little details that the author is expecting you to hear and think about. And again, we're in a Persian court, but the wording is hearkening us back to Israel.
That phrase is in Hebrew, says about Jonathan and David?
Yeah, in Hebrew. I can find it for you.
Was it a narrator in the story? Was it a poem?
It's Samuel talking to Saul, saying, God has taken your kingdom and given it to your Reah, who is better than you. And we know that that's David.
Okay.
If you want the exact reference, I didn't write it down, but we can find it. So little phrases like that, you know, you're thinking immediately back to issues of kingdom. And we discussed, if you remember from last year, who was here last year for Purim?
Me.
Bible studies.
I wasn't here.
So we did a Bible study showing all the connections with Saul.
Right.
Which there are many of, because Mordechai is the son of Kish. So he's somehow a descendant. Saul's father is Kish. They're both Benjamites. And so there's the whole connection of seeing Esther, like good kingship, bad kingship, some of these themes. And then seeing Esther as a new Saul, but a redeemed Saul, and she makes up for his lack. So where he was silent, or when he was inactive, and he shouldn't have been, Esther takes initiative and does something. But then there's also the whole connection here is where Saul loses his kingship and it gets given to David with those same words. And now we have a Persian queen, Vashti, who loses her kingship and it's going to be given to someone better than her. And so far we haven't heard anything about Esther and Mordecai, right?
No.
We're all still talking about Persians. So there's kind of that, again, that tension. And yet we're seeing in the language, we've already been reminded of the temple. We've already been reminded of this phrase that goes back to kings of Israel, kings of Judah. So we're already aware that there's subtleties and there's something that's going to happen and it has nothing to do with the Persians, essentially. Okay. So, verse 20... why don't you, someone just finish the chapter there.
Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Go on. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in his own script and to each people in their own language, and proclaiming that every man should be ruling over his own household using his native tongue.
So
pretty powerful stuff for everybody here.
I think we end chapter 1 laughing. Can you imagine getting a royal edict? You're like, oh, what's the king saying? What new thing's going on?
Yeah, oh, so you teach your kids in English.
Every man's supposed to rule his house. They're like, what? What kind of royal edict is that? First of all, if that's already the case in your culture, why would you need a royal edict to say it? And if that wasn't the case, why is the king interfering in, like, it's just so absurd. So I can just see a bunch of people gathering around the town center reading this edict thinking, this is crazy.
the respect for politicians that people have now.
And of course there's the irony of a king who the whole point is that his word is respected. But whose word is this coming from? It's one of his advisors. It wasn't even his word. You know, he likes the idea. So he's a bit of a puppet king.
Let's talk about John Kerry next.
And then, well, you guys can follow your little threads into modernity. But the beginning of chapter 2, after these things, when the king's wrath had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed about her. All of a sudden, in the king's memory, he didn't make the decree. It was decreed about her. And, oh no, now he's sober and misses her.
In mine it says what he had decreed about her.
Well...
Is that wrong?
Yes. I mean, in the sense, it is true. He's right. The king, so he gave the stamp.
Right.
This is a royal decree,
no,
right?
I was thinking of the Hebrew.
But literally it says, what was decreed? Nigzar.
Okay. Okay.
What had been decreed. And so it's a subtle way of hinting that he didn't take ownership of that decision. It was like he views himself kind of blocked by the law. Which is hilarious, because the law was set in place to make him powerful, and here he is blocked by his own law. And again, it's the king's young advisors, Na'are HaMelech, in verse 2,
yeah.
who come up with a plan for him.
Yeah, and he liked the proposal. So again, it's,
yeah, again, it's not his own proposal. And they're a bunch of young guys, and they say, here's a plan. Let's get a bunch of good-looking virgins together. And you know, it gives a whole system of how you can do it throughout all the kingdom. Gather them all together. And then, you know, they'll get all these lavish treatments, all this stuff, and then you can choose the one you want. And we have run out of time to go into the details, but you can also you can specifically compare this advice to the advice given David at the end of his kingship when he is cold. And so again, every time we're given these little words, like Vayafked lines up with that, and gathering a beautiful person. In that case, it turned out to be Abishag. Mm. But once you get these comparisons, then it also points out the differences. And I think a key one is the Persian king. He's going to gather a ton of girls together and try them all out. Where David, it mentions they're going to find one beautiful girl and that person will be picked first, before the king even sees her. And of course, he doesn't even, I mean, she just warms his bed. Nothing else happens. Like, the text tells you that. So there's a big contrast there. And it does reflect on the Persian king, and his attitude towards women is obviously not nice. I mean, he has no respect for what happens to that person afterwards. All the girls that come in that he doesn't choose, he's destroyed their life.
Oh.
They're never going to get married. They have to sit in his harem forever, never being called again,
right,
just hanging out. So so it's really a terrible thing.
Going back to Solomon.
Yeah, well...
No, because Solomon's wasn't a harem so much. He had concubines. And they all had babies, didn't they?
Never. I don't know if we have a listing of babies. I'm sure they did have babies.
Maybe these girls do too.
Maybe they do too. But they certainly, it wouldn't be a bright and shining future.
Right.
Wasn't there a lesson a while back that that was what kings did? That kings, as long as they were viral, they were...
Look, you can try to justify that's what kings did, this or that, but again, on the spectrum of kings...
We had a lesson a few months ago that this is how the kings... showed their dominance, their programming.
It might be, but in having concubines, yes, and in making alliances with other countries, yes. But I think this is a different issue because this, first of all, was unnecessary from the beginning. To choose a new queen, you don't have to try out every beautiful woman in your empire. You know. It's ridiculous. And certainly, you could line them all up and have a fashion show and choose one and decide if you like her. You know, there are other ways to go about doing this, and his was not the most thoughtful in terms of the future of that contestant. And so, since we're out of time, I'll leave you with some questions. We still have another week till Purim. But think about this. As you start into chapter 2, Esther's about to be introduced in the context of a new queen. So we're already kind of going in that direction of understanding what the story's about. But does Esther want to be queen?
No.
Not really.
How do we know? Does Mordecai want Esther to be queen?
Yes.
How do we know?
There's such a time as this. I don't know.
And the other question to ask yourself is, why does Mordecai tell Esther to keep her Jewish identity a secret?
Because by that time, Haman's made another of his decrees.
No, there's no Haman involved yet. This is before she gets taken as one of these beautiful contestants. Why does he tell her to keep her Jewish identity a secret? And actually, if you read through chapter 2, it's very well built verbally. There are two sections, and in both sections, before and after she's chosen, she is told by Mordecai to keep her identity a secret. And so it's interesting. I'm not offering a simple answer here. I'm actually saying think about it. But one thing it does do is it helps you, when you read the story, be very aware of secrets, that there is some intention for you to understand there are secrets going on. And if you're ignoring those secrets and only reading the words, you will miss the story. So that's just in Esther's identity, the author is able to tell you this, which is nice. And it makes you ask a question. You know, what does she want to be queen, or doesn't she?
Answers on a postcard next Shabbat.
That's right. Well, if Gary wants to, Gary's up for teaching next Shabbat. So
you know what? This is the conspiracy of the saints.
Conspiracy of the saints. Well, there were two views in traditional interpretation. You know, that of course Mordecai wanted her to become queen because he had had a prophetic vision knowing that it was just such a time as this, you know, for the redemption thing. And so, yes, he wanted her to conceal her identity so that she would get chosen as just on the same plane as everybody else. And then others would say no, he wanted her to conceal her identity so she wouldn't be chosen. And like when it gets to all these elaborate dunkings and baths of myrrh and all of this, don't take that so you can look ugly. You know, all these people can ask for anything they want, you know, diamonds, feathers, I don't know what. She asks for nothing. Why? Is she just a natural? Or does she actually not want to get chosen? So that's part of the question. Okay. So we will end there.
I promise that Aaron Foster's the evening of the 4th of March, which is Wednesday.
Wednesday, yeah.
And
last
Thursday,
2 days.
And then Friday
is Shushan.